.net, N-E-T. That means they're a member. Only the call letters ARRL.org are the officers of the American Radio Relay League. So the officers are .org. But all of the members that elect to do so are .net. And a nice advantage of doing that is that ARRL will act as a filter for you and get rid of the vast majority of the malware and spam and whatever. And so they will take the way you sign up if you're a member of ARRL is you ask for that service, and any email that's sent to your call letters at ARRL.net gets filtered through their filter, and most of the spam and other jazz is removed, and then it's sent on to your real call letters, so to speak, your real email address. So they're a beautiful alias that everybody can easily remember. K2 Yankee Oscar, K2RIW on the TechNet. Go ahead, Bernie.
Okay, thank you, gentlemen. All of the concern over doctoral theses and all that kind of stuff is irrelevant on this case. It's a 14-year-old sophomore in high school. I think he's a sophomore. So I gave his father my business card. I didn't want to extend it to him directly just because of various propriety issues, et cetera. But I gave his father my card and said, here, call me with any questions. It's got my cell phone on it. So we should be good there. I apologize. I didn't even think about trying the league's email addresses. I personally don't have one. I am a league member, but I don't have an address at the league, so I just didn't even think about that. So anyway, I will pass that back to them through channels, and I agree with you about the best answers are always the direct ones, but in this case, he stumped me. He had attempted to send an email himself, the young man had, and had been stumped by it. And I think he was somewhat pleased to see that an amateur extra was stumped by it. So we'll have an answer for him next time, K2IO.
Bernie, I'm a little bit curious. RYY recognized. Bernie, I'm a little bit curious why you have elected not to use that beautiful alias service and spam filter of ARRL.net. I'm wondering why you've elected not to use that service, Bernie. K2IO, K2RIW.
I run my own email server. I have both an address at cybertechservices.com and at huntfamily.com. So I have my own spam blocking, all that kind of stuff. So all of my emails hosted in-house. I also post mine on QRZ, so if anybody wants to get in touch with me, they can get to me that way.
Very fine. Joe, W-H-U-R-Y-Y, go right ahead.
I'm just signing in with a question. That's all I'm doing. I'm not going to add to what you're talking about already. So just, I'm here and I'm on IRLP, so you have to allow some delay.
Okay. I'm going to allow some delay. Fire away with your question.
Okay, Dick, good evening to you. In your opinion, because you seem to always have an expert opinion on many, many things, with the radiation of a small omnidirectional vertical, made by CellWave, would that appreciably change a lot or a little as you rotate the antenna in different directions? Vertically, it's vertically polarized. The reason I'm asking this is because I had a friend of mine who he changed the elevation of the antenna, and what he did in doing that was he had the ground plane radials or the radials on this antenna point in a different direction than previously was, and he claims it made a difference in the radiation pattern. Do you agree with something like this or disagree with something like this? W-H-R-Y-Y. The antenna gain is approximately 5 dB out of this antenna, about a 8-footer.
I'm going to give you the inverse problem as a way of explaining why I think there's no problem here. If I intentionally wanted to make a azimuthal antenna pattern. In other words, I got this vertically polarized collinear antenna, and for some reason I want to favor the north direction as opposed to the south, east, and west direction. I want to favor a particular direction on that antenna. In order to create that directivity pattern, I'm in theory defining a certain horizontal beamwidth. The horizontal beamwidth is only determined by the amount of horizontal real estate I have devoted. If I've made the antenna two wavelengths wide, horizontally, I divide 2 into 70 degrees. The magic number is take the number of wavelengths in that dimension, divide it into 70 degrees, and the answer is the achievable beamwidth. If my antenna had 2 wavelengths of horizontal real estate in its structure, I divide 2 into 70, I get 35. It is capable of having a 35-degree beamwidth if I do everything just right. So now if I play that backwards, what's the biggest horizontal dimension to this vertical antenna? It is such a small fraction of a wavelength, it doesn't have the capability to have a significant azimuthal pattern. Yeah, because of those three little radios sticking out of the bottom do slightly favor a certain direction. If I flew a helicopter around that antenna and I mounted it at the top of a tower in a thoroughly symmetric manner, I think I will find at best half a dB of peak and valley as I fly that helicopter around the antenna.
Repeater, timeout. Repeater, timeout. Cancel.
I fly that helicopter around the antenna at just the right altitude so that I'm really in the vertical beamwidth, and I fly a constant radius circle around it, I'm going to find half a dB of peak and valley. In the real world, you are going to get some definite peaks and valleys if you do that helicopter experiment, because it's in the vicinity of other objects. There's trees and water towers and utility poles and the house and all the metal that's in the house that your eye doesn't see and so on. All kinds of things in the multipath of the true environment are going to give you peaks and valleys, created by the environment, not the antenna. You could also, if you wanted to really do the experiment, you could set up a antenna rotating device underneath the antenna and some kind of a detecting device in a tree off at some appropriate distance and really rotate the antenna and really find out how much peak and valley. I'll be amazed if you saw a half a dB of peak and valley. I won't say it's impossible. So my first test, my first guess, Joe, is that the environment first, and after that, I just don't think the antenna can do it. W2RYY, K2RYW in the TechNet.
The antenna is used at for a repeater, and it's on about an 11-story building. And it doesn't really have any trees or anywhere near the same height as the building, so the trees are not a factor in the area. And with the other metallic objects that are on top of this thing that are vertically mounted are quite a ways away from the antenna, more than, you know, there's several wavelengths away, so I don't think they'd be a contributing factor as far as the horizontal polar plot of the antenna. Just a question I thought I'd ask, because he threw it at me, and I said, you know, I don't think that the manufacturer would say something like that if it was actually true, if it made that kind of difference from seeing, you know, the horizontal polar plots of these antennas as listed in a catalog. They don't seem to indicate any kind of major difference as you go in different directions in the antenna. That's why it's supposed to be, you know, an omnidirectional antenna. Okay, very good. Back to Ned.
Yeah, the highest probability is this the environment, Joe. I'm now going to give you a hard example. A bunch of buddies I know at the, what's the name of the organization? Symbol Amateur Radio Group, Symbol Technology, used to be A2STI, can't even think of their call letters. Anyhow, there's a repeater out in Holtzville at Symbol Technology, a 2-meter repeater. The antenna is something like 20 feet above the roof, but unfortunately the antenna is set back from the edge of the roof by about 200 feet. So there's 200 feet of roof in front of the antenna. The antenna is about 20 foot higher than the roof and the parapet and everything else. But the way the multipath happens off the building and whatever structure is in the building below the antenna is such that it's creating a really beautiful null in the dead western direction, which is directly down the Long Island Expressway. The net result is you can measure the sensitivity of the repeater. You know exactly how many microvolts it's got. You know how much power it's putting out. You drive down the expressway to the west of that building. You get about 3 expressway stops, and the signal stops. There's a huge null in that direction created by the building itself and the multipath. So So the environment can really, I know damn well that that omnidirectional antenna cannot have a null in that direction, but it is acting like it's got, let me pick a number, a 15, a 20 dB null in that direction. And so when they eventually get the permission to mount the antenna near the edge of the roof, I think almost all of that effect will go away. To B2RYY for any further comments, K2RYW on the TechNet.
With what you just described, if you think of the topography of Long Island, there's actually a little bit of a hill at exit 59, and if you go past that, going westbound, you drop down severely. That might also account for your loss of signal, or severe loss of signal, at, you said, three exits away, because that would be about three exits, 61 to, say, 59, 58.
That's a good point, Joe, and that's definitely an aggravating factor. But if you stand at roof level and look at that direction, you've got beautiful line of sight. I don't even have to climb 20 feet of mast to know what the antenna is seeing. And yes, there is a bit of a dip there. But as I get to my home QTH, 300 feet above sea level, and now again, except for the trees in between, I've got line of sight back to that building, I get very poor coverage. The repeater cannot be in that insensitive, if you know what I mean. So there's something funny going on with the multipath off that building. That's what I believe it is. And the proof will be when we finally get the permission, when they finally get the permission to mount the antenna at the edge of the building. Okay. Stand by for a second. At this time, we normally go into the deeper material. And one of the questions that Wesley has asked a number of times this week, before I went away for 3 days to Buffalo to go to my nephew's wedding, is what is the frequency of a lightning bolt? Darn good question. And the answer is it's got lots of frequencies. If I made an impulse generator, and that's exactly what you're doing when you take a step recovery diode made by Hewlett-Packard, and you go to technical note number 940, I think it is, and you read about step recovery diodes. And if I feed a RF signal into that step recovery diode of 100 megacycles, and I've done that experiment, I own a piece of equipment like this, you put a half-watt signal at 100 megacycles into the step recovery diode. What does it do? On the positive half cycle of that 100 megacycles, you're charging up this diode. You're putting energy into its junction. On the negative half cycle, you're taking that charge back out of the diode, out of the intrinsic region between the N and the P inside the diode. It's a specially made diode where it stores energy and gives it back. But it's got a very peculiar characteristic in that on the negative half cycle, you're taking the energy back out of the diode, and when it suddenly runs out of energy in the middle of that negative half wave, it abruptly goes from full negative current to zero negative current, and it does it in a small fraction of a picosecond. It is fast. Let me drop. When you study a branch of mathematics, and you study what happens with a so-called Dirac delta function, an impulse function, and you ask yourself the question, what frequency does it have? The answer is every single frequency DC to light. And I'm not kidding. Every single frequency is there. Only thing left to discuss is how broadband and how much energy. If I made the step recovery diode have a reverse recovery time, snap action time, whatever it's called, of, let me think now, a nanosecond is 1 gig. Let me make it 10 picoseconds. Yeah, 10 picoseconds. 10 picoseconds, I think, is the inverse of 100 gigs. If I could make the inverse recovery time, one nanosecond is 1 gig, 100 nanoseconds would be 10 gigs. Yeah, let me make it 10. If I could make it 10 picoseconds, and I look at the energy coming out of the diode, it would be flat out in energy, frequency-wise, until you got to 1 over that recovery time. It would have energy of every possible frequency, from 0 to beyond 10 gigahertz. But because I'm doing it in a repetitive manner, I'm giving it a 100 megacycle signal. The signal I'm giving it every 10 nanoseconds is going through another cycle. So because of the repetitiveness of the signal, you take this broadband spectrum of each individual spike and you lay them on top of each other. It's called a spectral overlay. net result is it is a beautiful comb generator. It makes a zillion comb lines that you'll see on your spectrum analyzer. Every 100.000 megacycle, you see a whole bunch of comb lines across the screen. Every one of them is exactly 100 megacycles spaced. Every one of them is exactly the same amplitude. The strangest looking thing you've ever seen is a signal on the spectrum.
Repeater, timeout, cancel.
The particular step recovery diode I was using on this project had a recovery time that was something like 1 over 10 gigahertz. So the individual 100 megacycle lines go out to 10 gigahertz. Every one of them is exact same height. So that means 100 megs, that's 10 per gig, that's 10 gigs. There's more than 100 lines there, all identical in amplitude, until you get out to 10 gigahertz, and then they slowly start falling off. They all get the exact same spacing, but they start getting a little bit weaker. So once you study impulse devices and repetitive impulse devices, you realize you're working with things that are extremely broad in frequency spectrum. A lightning bolt, when it occurs, after it's gone through its leader strokes and eventually gets the real high current flash, I'm not quite sure what the real high current flash rise time is, but if someone told me it is a quarter of a microsecond or a tenth of a microsecond, I'd believe it. So therefore, the energy coming out of that lightning bolt is extremely broadband, and a tenth of a microsecond means that the lightning has significant energy out to at least 10 megacycles and then starts slowly falling off, probably at 6 dB per active. And if I looked at 30 megacycles, there's still a lot of energy there. And the net result is that when you and I tune across the HF band, and if anywhere within the propagation range of your antenna, depending on the state of the ionosphere, you may be listening to what's going on to the nearest 2,000 miles radius. So if somewhere in that 2,000 mile radius there is a thunderstorm, you're going to be hearing those individual lightning crashes, and you could have 10 receivers side by side. Let me drop. Where one of those receivers is tuned to 1 megacycle, one of them is tuned to 3.5 megs, one of them is tuned to 14 megs, one of them is tuned to 21 megs, one of them is tuned to 28 megs, and you'll hear the exact same lightning crash at almost the exact same instant of time coming out of, as a crashing clunk of noise, coming out of every one of those receivers. That would be proof positive that signal from that lightning blast is extremely broadband. But it's starting to fall off real fast at around 10 megacycles or so because of its rise time, or fall time, but most likely its rise time. By the time you get up to 144 megacycles, and it's been falling off 6 dB per octave, you've got a good sense of the receiver. You're still going to hear within the range of your 2 megacycle receiver, you'll still hear the lightning crash, but it's going to be a lot, lot weaker. So as you go up in frequency, the ionosphere is letting you listen to a different portion of the Earth's surface, which either does or doesn't contain a lightning storm. By the time you get up to 2 meters, 144 megacycles, the lightning crash itself is falling off at 6 dB per octave, and the range of your antenna and the ionosphere is mostly not helping you, except for a very rare sporadic E propagation on 2 meters. You're not going to have the range, therefore the lightning storm is not going to be within that range. So you don't hear lightning crashes on 2 meters, but they are there. If you're a good moon-bounce operator, and if there's a lightning storm within the range of your antenna, you're going to hear it. So what frequency does the lightning bolt have? To some degree, all frequencies. The only thing left to discuss is how strong is it at each frequency. And they're all lined up at the exact same instant of time, all those frequencies. I wonder if that helps a little bit, Wesley. N2XJN, the guy who asked the question, K2LIW in the TechNet.
Thank you very much, Dick, N2XJN. Very interesting answer, and very much unusual one. I approached a few figures on this repeater. And basically the answer that I've got was, it's DC, isn't it? It should be DC. And then I was thinking, okay, if it's DC, where can I hear it on the radio? Now, power dissipation and power distribution of the striking, lightning strike. If you can say something about it.
A lightning strike has a strong characteristic similarity to EMP. EMP stands for electromagnetic pulse. When you set off a nuclear device, an atomic bomb, what happens at the instant of exploding the atomic bomb, let me drop, yeah, double checking that the speech processor is turned on. At the instant of a couple of microseconds of the real action of that atomic bomb, a whole bunch of Compton electrons, high velocity electrons, come flying out of that, the center of that device. And a lot of energy is there across the frequency spectrum. It again is a very fast rise time, charge, current flow, call it what you like. It has strong similarity to a lightning bolt. An electromagnetic pulse has a lot of energy out to, I'm not quite sure, but maybe it's something like 30 megacycles, and it starts falling off real fast at 60 dB per octave. So for the first 0 to 30 megs, there's a lot of energy. And if you Google the word EMP, and you find the right article in the right book, they have made measurements, and they can tell you exactly how much energy exists at each megacycle or each kilohertz, if you know what I mean. Because it is broadband energy, coincident with the rise time of the pulse, you have to use a different set of units. If I set up a transmitter at 7 megacycles, and I put it into a dipole antenna, I'm radiating 100 watts of power, and if I had free space propagation, and X number of miles away, I set up another dipole, by the laws of propagation and the number of watts you're transmitting, I can tell you exactly how many milliwatts or microwatts or microvolts you're going to get off that receiving antenna. That's pure...
Repeater, timeout, cancel.
That experiment that I just described is pure CW propagation, and it follows the inverse square law, and a guy like Mike or I could calculate for you exactly how much signal you're going to get. Now you start talking about noisy signal. If I had a noise generator, a diode noise generator that's used for an automatic noise figure indicator, the diode generator, if I've done a good job of designing it, is extremely broadband. In theory, I can buy a diode noise generator to be used for an automatic noise figure indicator where the diode noise generator is producing a predictable amount of noise from approximately 10 megacycles to 18 gigahertz inclusive across every one of those frequencies. In theory, you could plot the exact amount of noise power output, and it's relatively flat. The amount of noise power it puts out at, we'll say, 30 megacycles, and the amount of noise it puts out at 300 megacycles, and the noise power it puts out at 3 gigahertz is almost identical. It's a really flat noise generator if you've done a good job of making the design of that thing. I can tell you how you do it, but there's a catch. You don't measure the noise power in milliwatts, microwatts, watts. You measure it in dBm per megacycle. Because it is a broadband source of noise, you can only define the noise power after you have defined the bandwidth of your measuring instrumentation. A 50-ohm resistor at room temperature is putting out noise. Those electrons, those molecules in there are being agitated because it's at room temperature. It's roughly 290 degrees Kelvin, physical temperature. Let me drop. So it's individual molecules of the resistor inside your 50-ohm dummy load are sitting at 290 degrees Kelvin. They're being shaken back and forth by the thermal agitation. The electrons that are around each one of those molecules are also being shaken. Therefore, that 50-ohm resistor, every 50-ohm resistor you own, you do a careful laboratory measurement, you'll find out within a very small fraction of a dB of difference, they're all putting out exactly minus 114 dBm for each megacycle of bandwidth. We call that minus 14 dBm per megacycle. You have to define the bandwidth. And once you define the bandwidth and the power, we give it a slightly different name. We don't call it power. We call it power flux density, PFD. So you have to define the bandwidth when you're describing a broadband noisy-like signal. So a noise generator for an automatic noise figure indicator falls into that category. Each individual lightning crash falls into that category. How much noise power is it putting out at each frequency? You can draw a curve, and it has some degree of flatness, but beyond a certain frequency, it starts falling off pretty fast at 60 dB per megacycle. But to measure that noise power, you have to set the receiver that makes the measurement at some particular bandwidth. You set the bandwidth at 1 megacycle during that lightning crash, you'll end up with a certain amount of energy at that particular 1 megacycle of bandwidth at that center frequency. You might set it at 7 megacycles with 1 megacycle of bandwidth, and you'll get a certain amount of energy. Leave the center frequency exactly where it was, 7 megacycles, and instead of using 1 megacycle of bandwidth, you use 100 kc of bandwidth, 1/10 of bandwidth. You will measure exactly 1/10 of the amount of energy. The amplitude of the signal, when it's a broadband, spiky-like signal...
Repeater, timeout, cancel.
So each individual crash of a lightning bolt, or the noise power coming out of a noise power generator, or some other broadband noise-generating device, you have to define the bandwidth before you can define the measurement. And how much power at each frequency region, once you define the bandwidth, can be defined, can be looked up, can be documented. People have done that. So if you go to the right reference, guarantee you'll find out what a typical lightning bolt looks like in power spectral density. What the spectral index looks like. Spectral index is the word used by radio astronomers as to how fast the noise power falls off when you go up in frequency. If you get a copy of the book by Polyphaser on the subject of lightning, Polyphaser is a company that makes lightning arrestors, and they've got this beautiful $20 book. Well, that's what it was 10 or so years ago. I don't know what it costs now. But this $20 book, 8.5 by 11, white front cover, probably has about 150 pages to it. I'm not quite sure. Has a lot of information about what each individual typical or atypical lightning bolt looks like. How big, how often, how strong, how many volts, how much noise power, what frequencies, a lot of information. How do you protect from it, what kind of instrumentation, how much protection you get, and so on. If you've got interest in lightning, you want to see that Polyphaser book, in my opinion. And I can tell you on the next transmission a lot more about lightning, what little I know, that the voltage of the cloud, I can tell you approximately what that voltage is, and you're going to find out the voltage is 100 to 1 wrong from any reasonable prediction. N2XJN, K2LIW in the TechNet.
KC2QIQ with a comment.
Go ahead, Glenn.
I just wanted to mention, Dick, that, you know, in power supply design and EMI filtering designs and, you know, power ballasts, a standard that's used by the IEC, how they model it, you know, for lightning protection. In other words, normally if you pick up a piece of equipment, there's a certain amount of surge protection that's required to get a CE mark from the IEC. You know, you look on the back of a product and it'll say CE on the back. And typically that test is modeled with a 100 kilohertz ring wave at 6 kilovolts. Conducted to a power line, so, and the typical power lines are your 120, 208, you know, 1560 hertz, and also the 230, 400 volt AC power lines. So that it's typically a 100 kilohertz ring wave, and it's pretty well accepted by everyone that that's the kind of noise that would be expected from, you know, lightning strike on power line stick. K2RIW, KC2QIQ.
Yeah, run that by one more time. 100 kilohertz ring wave. Does that mean that you repeat the event 100,000 times per second? In other words, you're creating an event every 10 microseconds, and every 10 microseconds the event is a 6 kilovolt impulse, as if you're closing a switch, or you're conducting with a transistor, or you're arcing over a junction or whatever. Is that sort of what you're saying, Glenn? I'm trying to reinterpret the words. KC2QIQ, K2RIW.
Yeah, it's similar to that, Dick. Basically what it is it's a signal that, or an impulse, that starts from 0 volts, and immediately with a rise time, I think it has to be like less than a millisecond, it has to rise to 6 kilovolts, and it basically has decay that rolls off like inverse log E, kind of a, you know, almost like a capacitive kind of discharge that it rolls down at. And the rate from charge to discharge is 100 kilohertz, but it's only for, like, I think, somewhere between 5 and 10 pulses. I'll have to look at that test diagram one more time, but it's either 5 or 10 pulses. And then there's a wait time, like 10 seconds, and then it strikes again. And it has to do this in, like, all 360 degrees of phase. So in other words, when you fire this, like, 5 or 10 pulses of 100 kilohertz at 6 kV ring waves, you have to do this, like, once every 10 seconds. It has to be done so many times, I think, like, you know, 50 times or something like that. And it starts at the zero point of the 60 cycle waveform, and it goes up in like 10 degree increments. Some of the amended tests go like 0, 90, 180, and 360. You know, in other words, it covers 4 points for each, to make sure that you're covering each part of the line cycle, Dick. K2RIW, KC2QIQ.
And once again, what is that test called? Is that called a CE rating? Is that what I think you called it? Go ahead. Is it called CE12 or something like that? Give me the name of the rating function that you're describing. And is this a US/Canadian standard? Over to you, Glenn.
It's basically, right now, everybody's using this as the international standard. It's accepted everywhere, everywhere around the world. Any device you pick up, if you look on the back and you see a CE mark, it has to meet this test. And it's a EN/IEC standard, 61000-4-5. And I believe the test was originally done or started in 1995, and it's been amended since. There are different revisions of it, but 1995 is the original where this test has become kind of like standardized. And there are amendings to it, but I believe the latest revision is 6 kV. At one point, they had like a 2 kV standard, then it got pushed up to like, I think it goes in different levels. Like there's a 500 kV, a 500 volt level, a 1 kV level, a 4 kV level, and then a 6 kV level, which is commonly accepted now, Dick, for the CE mark. KC2QIQ.
Very interesting, and I can see what's going on here. Every real power system that you connect your electronics to, every time you plug it into the wall, in the worst case scenario, there are certain impulses that take place. Con Ed, a loco, is connecting and disconnecting a generator. Somebody in the adjacent laboratory is turning on a great big inductive machine, and he's closing a 100 ampere set of contacts on three phase, 220 volts or whatever. All kinds of impulses take place on power lines. And so this test, if I understand correctly, is intended to simulate, let's call it 98% of all the worst case scenarios that your chunk of electronics is likely to see in its lifetime. That if your chunk of electronics can survive this CE test, 61000-4-5 test, that you've got sort of a 98% guarantee that your chunk of electronics, when connected to a reasonable wall socket, is likely to survive and keep operating for the next 5 or 10 years. Is that approximately the intent of this CE rating, Glenn? KC2QIQ, K2RIW?
Yes, it is, and it can be certified right here in Long Island by UL. We have them right up the block in Melville. They do most of that testing and certifications. I've used, you know, had to have stuff tested there all the time to see if it meets that standard. So if you want to sell something internationally, it really has to have that mark on it. Otherwise, it would be very, very difficult to sell something internationally. So I'm very, very familiar with that test, but that's only one of a few for power line testing. In other words, you have the ring wave, you have EFT, which is kind of like a higher frequency pulse that hits repetition constantly, and that one you're basically looking for flicker or, you know, variation performance. Basically, the lightning test is survivability, no arc over or, any kind of a problem that would destroy the piece of equipment. EFT is more of a susceptibility test where you're actually seeing if any performance changes, and, of course, there's different grades or levels that a piece of equipment can pass. So it's also important to know not only that you have the mark, but which reading or level it was tested to. So there's EFT, surge, and then ring wave. So there's basically three sets of tests to get the proper CE marking, Dick. K2RIW, KC2, QIQ.
And Turkish. I have you two guys right now. I would like to go a little bit further. I have sent Dick and Glenn to compliment Dick with his Glenn with his work on the Tesla project. A document made for the Army, and that was V11LF Corona investigation from 1992, and that states about the Naval Command Control and Ocean Surveillance Center Division of Investigation of Corona. A very interesting article. I don't know if Dick was able to look at it, but I hope at least Glenn was able to look at it. You both gentlemen have it. But in the meantime, I want to go with the rest of the questions about lightning and to Exia. Well, if we have all of the frequencies from the lowest to the highest, so we're dealing with the electromagnetic wave, or actually whatever frequencies we choose. And then, question is, how could we measure, or if there is any way to measure, the current lag over the voltage? In other words, is can we measure the phase dependencies of the lightning? And another part of this question is, how minus is minus, how plus is plus? And to XJM. That means there is a person on the top of the mount, 10,000 feet, let's say 20,000, whatever, imaginary figure. And there is a person standing in between of the distance. And there is a person standing on the level of the sea. All of these three people are standing on the ground, which is the Earth. Question is there a difference of potential between them? And if so, then if you measure that, how big that potential would be? Dick, back to you, and turn to you.
The answer is yes, there's a difference. And you got to be careful in how you define terms. The ionosphere on the average day, I don't know the exact number, but it's something in the vicinity of 300 kilovolts. The ionosphere is positive with reference to the Earth, something like 300 kilovolts. And you go to the right reference, you can find out how many kilometers high is the ionosphere, how many miles or kilometers it is above the Earth. The air that's in between the ionosphere, well, the ionosphere is well above the air, but still, you've got a mildly conducting plasma-like material in the ionosphere itself. And as you get down to lower and lower altitudes, you get lower and lower plasma densities, and eventually you start running into the air itself. And the air is a extremely mildly conducting volumetric material. As such, one of the experiments that me and a guy named Mario Di Diego did, we copied an article out of, what was it now, Flying Models magazine, way back in 1970. Let me drop. I can't think of the man's name, but he works at Johns Hopkins Applied Physics Laboratory in Maryland. And what he did was to take a yardstick and to put two polonium sources, one on the right-hand side, one on the left-hand side of the yardstick. And he ran a wire from each of the metallic cage that was holding the polonium source. He ran a wire to the center of the yardstick, and there he put a operational amplifier. One polonium source on the right side went to the positive input, and the other one went to the negative input of this operational amplifier. and the output of the operational amplifier went to a Dawson valve meter movement, and there was a small 9-volt battery on this thing to run it, and a couple of resistors and whatever, feedback. The net result was that as you took this yardstick and lay it parallel to the ground and properly balanced the equipment, this zero center meter would be in the center of its scale. When you tilted the yardstick to the left so that the right-hand polonium source was higher than the left-hand polonium source, the mildly conducting air sensed the fact that there's something like 2 volts per meter of electrostatic potential as you go up and down in altitude through that air. Each polonium source is creating an ionized cloud around it, which makes the equivalent of a large metallic sphere that grabs onto the air in that area, so to speak, and measures its potential. So the voltage pickup difference between the right-hand side and the left-hand side of the yardstick as you tilted it made the operational amplifier develop a voltage. The voltage through the right resistor was sent to the meter, and the meter would tilt to the right. It would go read above zero. So when you set...
Repeater, timeout, cancel.
When you set this thing up correctly, you could tilt this yardstick left and right, raise it up and down. At all times, the zero centimeter in the middle would always stay, the needle would always stay perpendicular to the ground. It's a strange thing to watch it work. That's when you're standing in an open field. That's what it does. Bring it inside the building, and it stops doing that. You tilt it left and right, and the meter stays at zero. So the conductivity of the building, even if it was a wooden building, or if you walked under a tree, it stopped working. You had to be in the middle of an open field in order to sense that voltage. So that voltage potential difference, that's something like 1 or 2 volts per meter vertically displaced. In other words, if you measured the voltage with reference to Earth, and you got a sensing device, and you measured 1 meter above the ground, 2 meters above the ground, 3 meters above the ground, you'll measure something in the vicinity of 2 volts per meter, as I remember. That's close magnitude. So the air is mildly conducting. The person standing on the mountain at the 10,000 foot level, his head is in contact with air that wants to be at a higher potential. Maybe that mountain 10,000 feet up, let's see now, 2 volts per meter, we could calculate 10,000 feet is probably 3,000 meters, 6,000 volts. In other words, the air half a mile in front of him is 6,000 volts more positive than the air at Earth level. But as you get closer and closer to the mountain, and that mountain is a hell of a lot more conductive than that air, that potential 2 volts per meter starts taking on a tilt. If I plotted the equal potential surfaces, those surfaces would lie parallel to the side of that mountain. Same thing happens when you... He used this device. He put it on the tips of the wing...
Repeater, timeout, cancel.
He puts this electronics on the tips of the wing of a radio control model airplane. And by remote control, he could fly the airplane and then flip the switch, which went over to the automatic mode. And because he had one of these polonium sources on the left wing and the right wing, and one on the nose and one on the tail, in the automatic mode, the airplane would always fly straight and level. Beautifully straight and level, no matter what the wind was doing. Beautiful control. Unless he flew near a tree. And then the airplane would tilt itself, trying to be parallel to the tree, if you know what I mean. If he flew it alongside of that mountain, the airplane would try to fly with its wings parallel to the tilt of the side of that mountain, because that's the way the air potential is exerting itself, because the air is a mildly conducting surface, and that Earth is a highly conducting surface. So if the guy on the side of the mountain, if his head is 3 meters above the ground, and the guy at sea level, if his head is 3 meters above the ground, and you take a careful measurement of the air in the vicinity of their head with reference to local ground, you'll end up with the same number because of the way the equal potential surfaces rearrange themselves. I wonder if that makes a little bit more sense. It's not an easy concept to understand. N2XJN, K2LIW in the TechNet.
Yeah, I wonder, would that explain the experiment that Glenn once did in Florida when he was able to measure the difference between his antenna and the ground. Maybe Glenn could refer to that.
Yeah, when you start measuring DC voltages of the kind that I'm talking about, on a clear, dry day, you get a nice, reasonable answer. On a rainy day, all hell breaks loose. You've got all kinds of charges flowing through the air, and the air becomes much more conductive when it's got water in it. So all these normal potentials change a lot. I'm reasonably sure Maynard Hill was the guy's name. I'm reasonably sure that Maynard Hill's automatic leveling system for his radio control model airplane, I believe it failed to operate at all during a rainstorm. Let's see what Glenn remembers from his voltage measurements on his antenna in Florida. And he wasn't that far away from Gainesville, the lightning capital of the United States. KC2QIQ, if you're available. K2RIW and TechNet. Go ahead, Glenn.
Yeah, I kind of have a maverick version of what lightning is, and there's a few people I've kind of discussed it with, and I'm not sure if you guys really want to hear it, but I'll go through it if you want me to. Over to K2RW, KC2QIQ.
I'm going to give you one other. I own a couple of lightning books, and they don't all agree with each other, but I'm going to tell you what little I've sort of gleaned. By various techniques, you can fly radio control model airplanes, and in some cases you can make ground measurements and make some assumptions. You'll eventually discover that the amount of charge in a cloud that's capable of making lightning frequently are numbers like 10 megavolts, 10 million volts of positive charge or negative charge, usually negative charge on the bottom of the cloud, but not always. So the bottom of the cloud could be 10 million volts negative with reference to Earth. And that cloud might be, let me pick a number, an easy kilometer above the Earth. The dielectric strength of ordinary air is 30,000 volts per centimeter, which equals 3 million volts per meter. So if I've got two metallic spheres 1 meter apart, and I keep raising the voltage until I get an arc, it's going to take something close to 3 million volts to do that. And the cloud only has 10 million volts. That would lead you to believe the cloud can only arc some air for a few meters. And maybe the number is not 10 million, maybe it's 100 million. But in order to arc the cloud to ground under normal circumstances at 3 million volts per meter and 1 kilometer of altitude, you multiply those three together, the cloud better be charged at 9 gigavolts, 9 billion volts. Almost no cloud has anywhere near that amount of voltage on it.
Right on.
With 9 billion volts required, you would say you're never going to get lightning. And yet lightning happens all the time. It just so happens you've got enough voltage on the cloud to arc the first 120 feet. What is that? Something like 40 meters. So the cloud has enough voltage to arc the air for the first 40 meters. And that's the first little bit of the lightning strike. Then another cosmic ray comes along, ionizes another path of air, and you get another 40 meters of barking. So when you look at a lightning bolt, it's got a whole lot of zigzags to it, and on average, each of those zigzags is 40 meters long, because it has enough voltage to arc that far. And then it waits for another cosmic ray to ionize the path in front of it. And if there isn't another cosmic ray at the right time, the lightning bolt dies and never forms in the first place. You look at a lightning bolt, in most cases it looks like an inverted tree, and some of those branches of tree never make it all the way to the ground. They're the ones where a cosmic ray didn't come along at the right time. Now, this is some of my understanding. Why don't you add to it from your experience first, Glenn? KC2QIQ, K2RIW in the TechNet.
From what I've been studying of it so far, and some of it is conjecture and a lot of it is based on somewhat of scientific fact, but I haven't had anybody really yet disagree with it to the point to where they could prove it negative. And so far I've had a lot of people that are kind of coming along and agreeing with this. And what's happening is one cloud by itself, I don't believe, can cause lightning. What you need is two clouds of dissimilar charge. And when the two cloud fronts actually impact each other, that's when you're going to have the difference in charge between the two bodies of dissimilar charge. And the lightning strikes, let me let this drop for a second. When you're looking up in the sky and you see a lightning strike that looks like a mile long in the sky, and the lightning is not, the voltage is not going along the strike a mile long, because like you said, you need gigavolts to do that. But you can have micro arcs between the two cloud fronts. So what you're seeing is where the two dissimilar clouds of dissimilar charge are bumping into each other. In other words, one cloud at one charge level, another cloud at another, the two clouds strike each other. At the points of where they're striking, you're seeing the arcing between the two clouds, and the two clouds could be a mile long. And when those two fronts hit each other, that's the those arcs are actually very small distances, but they're very, very high energy. They're very, very bright, very, very loud. A lot of energy is taking place between those two bodies when they come together, and you're just seeing that raggedy-looking arcing between the two clouds. So it's not necessarily going from the cloud to ground. It's going between the two bodies. And anything that gets caught in between those two dissimilar charges is going to have trouble. That's why if you look at the top of a tree, and as one cloud comes from one side and another dissimilar cloud's on the other side, and the tree gets caught in between where those two come together, and that's where the zap takes place. Over to you, Dick. K2RIW, KZ2QIQ.
The lightning books that I've read definitely say the majority of lightning is cloud to cloud. A much smaller percentage are cloud to ground. So the dissimilar charge between clouds, and they're spacing and they're moving around, that's where a lot of the discharging takes place. Stand by a second. Also, quite often when the charge is accumulating on the cloud, the bottom of the cloud is negative and the top of the cloud is positive. So discharge within the cloud itself very easily happens. Somehow by way of the convective action that takes place, when water vapor is condensing into water and the rising air currents are taking place, somehow the convection action creates a dissimilar charge, and the movement of those charges allows some kind of an accumulation that eventually, usually the bottom of the cloud has got a great big negative charge and the top of the cloud has got a positive charge. And the mechanism by which that happens is only vaguely understood. What really is the mechanism of making the charge and the charge accumulation? It's somehow a combination of convection and condensation. Somehow it does it. But once you do get the reverse condition, which occasionally happens where the bottom of the cloud is positive, and it decides to discharge to Earth, that's when you get these lightning bolts that are about 10 times higher in current or more than the negative ones. Those are those really potent ones that do a lot of damage and make a lot of noise. Let me drop. When it comes to your two-cloud theory and the discharge between them and the tree caught in between, I'm going to accept that as happening some of the time. My gut feel, though, is that an awful lot of tree damage that occurs on the top of High Hill in Huntington. You look at the trees on the top of High Hill, which is 400 feet above sea level, the tallest piece of land on Long Island. Half of all of those trees on the top of that hill have experienced a lot of lightning damage. More than half of them are dead. And my impression when looking at those trees is they were struck top down, not left side to right side. I think the majority of the damage to those trees occurs from cloud to ground. And does a cloud to ground strike require two clouds? I don't think so, but I'm not sure. And why does a cloud decide to discharge to ground instead of to another cloud? I guess because it's built up enough charge to start the process off, and there isn't another cloud nearby at the time. That's a pure guess on my part. Do you have an explanation for what initiates a cloud-to-ground strike, Glenn? KC2QIQ, K2RIW?
Well, here we go again. This is another one of my convoluted theories. One of the most dangerous places to be in a lightning storm is on a golf course. And if you ever look at the most dangerous conditions or any open field area, and usually the condition that really is dangerous is when you look on one side of it and you see clear sky, and on the other side you look and you see a storm front coming. And what's happening is on the side that's coming in, the storm, those dark clouds that are coming in, right where that storm front is hitting the dry air on the other side, which is a completely different potential at the other end. That's where all the lightning is taking place. Once that goes past, usually, and the rain is going, you get much less lightning. But the most dangerous part is that front leading edge as it comes through. And so, in other words, you have one set of, you know, density on one side and one set of charge, and another density and another set of charge on the other side, and it comes rolling in, and it moves along with it, and it's that right at that front. Now, there's other things like pockets. In other words, near the ground level, you can have like low-level pressure areas close to the ground, and the pressure that's maybe just even a few hundred feet above it could be at another. And as this, you know, if you just watch wind, how wind normally moves through trees, and as a storm front comes through, the air is moving in all kinds of different patterns, just not left to right. It winds up in pockets, and you can have energy or air charged at a certain energy level near the ground, and the other air that's coming along the top, and they can intersect close to ground level and have a discharge near ground level. Dick, K2RIW, KC2QIQ.
Yeah, the lightning books I've read will say that the most severe lightning tends to be at the leading edge of a moving storm. And so the moist air with all of the dark clouds in them and all of the convection and condensation taking place and the charge distribution within those clouds has all the potential to create the lightning. And it's moving into a drier mass of air. And wet air, by the way, is lighter, opposite of common sense. Everyone calls it heavy air. It feels heavy in a high humidity, hot day. You feel uncomfortable and you call it heavy air. But when you measure water vapor density, pounds per cubic meter, versus dry air, pounds per cubic meter, moist air is a hell of a lot lighter. It takes a lot more runway to take off your airplane on a hot, moist day as opposed to a cold, dry day. And even if you're taking 2 days of the exact same temperature, the moist day takes more runway than the dry day because moist air is lighter. So therefore, I guess the moving moist air wavefront, let me drop, tends to flow over top of the drier air, I think. I expected it to be under and therefore getting closer to the ground and therefore discharging more easily. But I think it comes in at over the drier air. And somehow the difference between the wet air and the dry air and the charge that's in the wet air somehow initiates these initial strikes. The dielectric strength of air is essentially not not dependent on moisture.
If you got visiting the Long Island Mobile Amateur Radio Club repeater system, code number 9126 on the New England reflector.
Link clear.
If you got two containers of air, one dry and one moist, and you measure the dielectric strength, you're going to get very close to 3 kilovolts per centimeter in both cases. So moisture in the air definitely changes the air's resistivity, conductivity, but doesn't change its dielectric strength. And so let me think about that. I guess it means that the moist air tends to be more of an equipotential surface, whereas the dry air, it's easier to develop a potential across a volume of that dry air. I wonder if that's a contributing factor to your scenario, Glenn. KC2QIQ, K2RIW in the TechNet.
I think it is, Dick. And what's happening is that, you know, the amount of energy in charge, that's why I think the ground systems work so well. In other words, when you're putting a ground rod in the ground, a nice deep one, what's happening is your whatever charge of air that's around your site, your antenna, your house, etc., you're actually bleeding off charge in that air to ground before it comes in contact with another surface that it can discharge against. And you're hoping that your tower, your antenna, your house doesn't, you know, wind up in between while this is taking place. So as long as you have a good discharge source that always keeps things closer to ground level, the less likely that you can build up those large charges around your home QTH or the item that you're trying to protect. But I believe it is along those lines. And here again, how the charge is actually being stored in one air mass versus another one, I'm not sure that it's a very, very easy explanation for that. And also the motion and you have also the wind power behind it, because what makes wind flow and move at certain rates? Why is one day windy and another day calm? Which cloud is going to go on top, which one's on the bottom? I think there are just so many variables here that it's really hard to put your finger on. And each storm is unique. You look at how the wind flows. I guess maybe, you know, you have one area that's more likely to have lightning because